Good morning, all. The first case for argument this morning is CE Design versus Prism Business Media. Mr. Oppenheim.
Please, the court. The case before us is not a Hobbs Act case. A Hobbs Act case is a case in which a party seeks an order enjoining, suspending, setting aside, or invalidating an agency regulation. This case, on the other hand, is a piece of private civil litigation between two private parties under the Federal Telephone Consumer Protection Act. The court can decide the liabilities of the parties in this case simply by referencing that statute, and there's no need for any sort of agency interpretation of that statute. Numerous courts, including this court in the United States Supreme Court, have applied standard statutory interpretation to situations like this, where a party brings a statutory claim and there is an FCC regulation of some sort that one party or other seeks to bring to the court's attention.
The defendant says that you filed more than 100 class actions under this act. Is that true? And if it is, what's happened in some of these other cases?
I'm not sure if the number is more than 100, but I submit that that might be true. We have had a number of class actions under the TCPA, and frankly, this is the first time that we have had this experience, although I know that other class action plaintiffs under the TCPA have encountered this Hobbs Act argument before. This case is the first opportunity for a federal appellate court to decide this question of whether clear language under the TCPA, whether the court's free to apply clear language under the TCPA, or whether the court is constrained by something that the FCC did just by virtue of the fact that the Hobbs Act says that the court can't invalidate something that the FCC does.
But so this is the first case that's percolated up to a federal appellate court. Where are the other ones?
Like I said, I don't believe that this issue is reached an opinion in any other case. I know that this has been something that's been raised on class certification motions recently is a reason not to certify a class. I don't believe that there is another decision that we have litigated where we've gotten a decision. I know that the Blitz case, I think that we have, or at least our firm has assisted in the appeal process. But in terms of CE Design, this is the first time CE Design is confronting this issue.
But CE Design itself has filed 100 or something in the neighborhood of that. I mean, a lot of class actions. Their fax machine must be very busy.
Well, I mean, they are a small company. They have 20 employees. They have one phone line, and having that fax machine free to conduct their business, which is a design business, so they're constantly communicating with their clients, is an important thing. And
now the fax in this case, though, had a notice on it that if you don't want to receive any more faxes, just let us know or something like that. Have they done that and ever received a fax after doing that that we know?
Not that I know of, Your Honor.
Okay.
This is a situation where they were a subscriber to some of the defendants' print magazines.
Okay.
And in the course of subscribing to those magazines, they filled out a contact card And among the line items on the contact card was the fax number. And that was essentially the loan communication. And then out of the blue, they got a fax for a trade show. And under the TCPA, it's unlawful to send an unsolicited fax advertisement, period. There's no grant of rulemaking authority to the FCC within that prohibition to create defenses. And, in fact, the statute then goes on to define unsolicited as being something lacking express permission or invitation. Congress, when it considered the TCPA, actually included an additional clause that would create such a defense, and then in its final version stripped that out. So I think that what that can tell us, along with the fact that the rest of the statute that deals with telephone solicitations, deals with various other prohibitions, contains numerous grants of rulemaking authority to fill in gaps and also creates situations where an established business relationship is a defense. And so I think we're dealing with the stark situation of clear statutory language being set up against an agency regulation, and the question before the court is, what significance does the agency regulation have? And I would submit that the Supreme Court under Chevron has answered this question, that in performing statutory analysis, the court needs to look at what the statute says, and if the statute's clear, that's the end of the matter.
I understand that you don't think this exception applies, this existing business relationship. If it does apply, do you agree that you fit under that definition?
Actually, Your Honor, we do not. And in fact, to the extent that the Hobbs Act requires that this exception be grafted onto the statute, the Hobbs Act equally requires the court to faithfully apply the definition of established business relationship that the FCC provided.
And but if you subscribe to three of their publications, why wouldn't that be enough to have an established business relationship?
Well, that's because the established business relationship is a term of art. It's a defined term within the 1992 FCC report and order.
Okay, but why don't you fit under the definition?
The definition is that that an established business relationship is something that can exist between a sender and a residential subscriber. And there's no dispute whatsoever that CE Design is a business subscriber to its fax line, not a residential subscriber. So in other words, established business relationship as defined in terms of providing whatever sort of defense it does provide under the TCPA is something that can exist, is a defense that's available only in situations where a faxer sends a fax to a residential fax subscriber.
Right. Doesn't that read the word business out of the definition?
Well, the word business, I don't believe, is in the definition.
Well, for an established business relationship, and you say it only applies to residents, sending it to a residence.
I understand, Your Honor. You can have a business relationship with a consumer. If I am a business and I'm advertising by fax, my advertisements may well go to individuals, to consumers. That's a business relationship that I might have with them.
But in a business relationship, though, the only reason that they have your fax number is that you gave its fax number to the defendant. Otherwise, they wouldn't have known it.
That's true, Your Honor. And the FCC.
And most businesses, a fax is sort of a business thing. I don't think many residences, maybe other than Judge Flom, but many residences would have their own fax machines.
Actually, Your Honor, in our experience, and we have brought numerous of these cases. There is a fair mix of individual residential line class members and business class members. And frankly, the only way I think that under any sort of statutory construction that we reach this established business relationship defense is if we give credence to defendant's Hobbs Act argument. And the crux of defendant's Hobbs Act argument is that courts are powerless, lack jurisdiction, to question anything that the FCC put in its order. And the FCC very clearly defined EBR as it did. Why it did that, I mean, we can stand here today and speculate, but the fact is they defined it as they defined it, and that definition doesn't fit CE design.
Judge Pallmeyer never certified a class in this. I mean, you got summary judgment before you got to that.
That's correct, Your Honor. And I think that the issue that we're rubbing up against in what sets this case apart from the Gecko case and the other Hobbs Act implicating cases on which Judge Pallmeyer relied and on which defendants rely it's twofold. Number one, this isn't a case where the FCC is a party being called into court to defend its actions. It isn't a case where anything the FCC did is central to defining the rights of the parties. Those rights were defined by the TCPA, and there really isn't any play in those statutory joints, as this court, I believe, said in the Krizalik case, to get into anything that the FCC may or may not have thought about what a defense to liability under the TCPA might be. And in fact, I think that the Global Crossing case that the Supreme Court just decided in 2007 is instructive. That was a situation in which the FCC promulgated a regulation, and there was a case brought in district court, a standard piece of civil litigation, which was appealed up through the normal channels of the Supreme Court, and in which what the FCC said was material to one of the claims or defenses in that litigation, but only to the effect as the Supreme Court, or to the extent as the Supreme Court said in its opinion that the regulation met Chevron deference. And that is all that we're asking the court to do here. The defendants, to the way I've seen and read everything, have not defended this regulation under Chevron. They've made no argument that I can tell that the statute is ambiguous so as to allow for an agency interpretation of any stripe to have any relevance to the consideration of the outcome. Nor have, in my mind, they advanced any theory under which this particular footnote 87 interpretation is a permissible construction of the TCPA. Rather, we're dealing solely with the argument that the Hobbs Act, by virtue of what it prohibits, prevents a court from exercising its normal statutory interpretation and deciding what level of deference to give an interpretation. The TCPA, and one other factor which I think is very important too, is that we have to remember that in 2003, the FCC itself changed its mind and no longer believed that the same statutory text from which it created this EBR defense allowed for one. And this court has also held that where an agency over time advances inconsistent interpretations.
They never made that effective, though, did they?
It, The order itself never went into effect. That is correct. What happened was it was issued as a final order, and in fact it was the subject, because it addressed more than just the fax prohibitions. It was a final order subject to Chevron review in the Satterfield case out in the Ninth Circuit. But as far as the fax provisions went, there were petitions to stay execution of the order, essentially. There were two, and they were both granted, and then the execution got pushed back to when the Congress passed the Junk Fax Protection Act. And I note that I have gone into my rebuttal time, so.
Thank you, Mr. Oppenheim. Ms. Trascoma?
Good morning. May it please the Court. My name is Teresa Trascoma, and I'm here on behalf of the appellee, Prism Business Media. Summary judgment in this case should be affirmed. The District Court correctly concluded that appellant's TCPA claim was foreclosed as a matter of law. The grant of summary judgment was properly based on the undisputed facts. There is no dispute that appellant was a subscriber for many years to at least three Prism publications. There is no dispute that appellant provided its fax number to Prism on at least two occasions. Appellant never opted out of receiving faxes. Based on this established business relationship, Prism sent a fax to appellant on August 2004. The grant of summary judgment was also based on a binding FCC rule implementing the Telephone Consumer Protection Act. This rule was first articulated by the FCC in a 1992 report and order implementing rules and regulations with respect to the TCPA. The FCC reaffirmed this rule in 1995 in another order. It affirmed the rule in dozens of enforcement actions, in notices to the public, and in 2003, there was a proposed rule change, a change that would not have been necessary had there been no rule in the first place. Prior to the 2000, and at the time of the proposed rule change in 2003, the FCC made clear that until that rule change went into effect, businesses complying with the FCC's rule in sending faxes to parties with whom they had an established business relationship were in full compliance with the TCPA and with the FCC's rules.
Why didn't that rule, that change, ever take effect?
It didn't. The FCC delayed the effective date of that rule change because it believed that Congress was about to act in this area, and in fact, Congress did act in 2005 with the passage of the Junk Fax Prevention Act, which codified an established business relationship exception to the TCPA.
As you're in the position you are now, it would apply to you?
That if the fax had been sent after 2005, the JFPA, the Junk Fax Prevention Act, would have applied. Because the fax at issue here was in August 2004, we were operating under the prior regime, which was under the FCC's rules. The district court correctly concluded that it had no jurisdiction to determine the validity of that rule. The Hobbs Act specifically forecloses, provides for exclusive jurisdiction in the courts of appeals for determining the validity of the rule. And the district court applied the Hobbs Act and applied binding precedent from this circuit, from this court, under Gecko, and concluded that it didn't have jurisdiction to invalidate the rule. Appellant seems to have scoured Westlaw and come up with over 100 cases in support of what I think are two principal arguments. The first argument, although I didn't hear it really today, is that the FCC's rule was not really a rule. It was not a rule that needed to be applied by the district court and could be ignored even if a court with proper jurisdiction had not yet invalidated it. There is no case that supports this view. It is inconsistent with Gecko, and consequently, appellant's position that the rule was mere commentary or interpretation has absolutely no support. The second argument is that somehow under Chevron, a district court or another court in a non-Hobbs Act case could ignore the rule and simply look at the statute. Chevron does not permit this. Indeed, Chevron was a case properly brought through a petition for a review of an agency regulation through a petition to the Court of Appeals pursuant to a congressional mandate of how statutory, how regulatory review was supposed to take place. There is nothing in Chevron or any subsequent cases from the Supreme Court that says that a court looking at an agency rule can simply apply the first step of Chevron and somehow, if it determines that the statute is unambiguous, can move on from, can simply ignore an otherwise applicable agency rule. I think that one case that's worth discussing because it was cited by appellant in its reply brief is the Global Crossing case. And I think if you look at that case carefully, and in particular if you look at Justice Scalia's dissent, you will see that that case is inapplicable here. It is true that it was brought, it was an action brought in district court. But what was at stake in Global Crossing was a very threshold question of whether there was a federal cause of action. It was a threshold question that the court had to look at. The FCC regulation in Global Crossing purported to create a federal cause of action for violation of an FCC regulation. That was, if you look at the question presented, if you look at argument, if you look at the briefs in that case, it's very clear that that was what was going on. It was not an effort to invalidate an agency rule. Instead, it was the court, a court exercising its fundamental duty to determine whether it had jurisdiction in that case. And to do that, the court needed to determine whether the federal agency regulation at issue was lawful and could, in effect, establish a cause of action for a violation of an agency regulation. The same, a similar type of issue was at stake in Core Communications, also cited by appellant. It's a Third Circuit decision, and it's similar to Global Crossing, although in some ways it's the other side of the coin. In that case, the question was whether the FCC could limit the federal court's jurisdiction to hear cases. And for that reason, I think that it is also inapposite. Appellant has also argued that there is that the EBR rule articulated repeatedly by the FCC somehow applied only to residential subscribers and not to business subscribers. This argument is rooted in the 1992 order and in particular with the regulations that the FCC included, with the very specific regulations that the FCC included in that order. Those regulations applied only to telephone calls. And if you look at where the definition of established business relationship comes in, it is as used in this section, and that section applies only to telephone calls. The statute governing prohibitions on telephone calls applied only to residences, so in that case it made sense. But if you look at subsequent orders from the FCC, it is very clear that the rule extended not only to residences, but also to any individual or entity with whom the fax sender had a business relationship. And the FCC enforced this rule against a number of businesses. We've included citations to those. In sum, I think that there is no basis to disturb the district court's grant of summary judgment in this case. I'm happy to address any particular questions that the court may have with respect to cases cited by the appellant, but if there are no questions.
Thank you, Ms. Trascoma. Mr. Oppenheim?
Allow me to be brief. In addressing the question about what the FCC defined the established business relationship to be, I think that if you look at the 1992 order, you'll find in paragraph 6 a paragraph entitled definitions, I believe, in which it states the definitions of certain defined terms used throughout this order can be found in Appendix B. If you look at Appendix B, the subpart in which the established business relationship definition can be found discusses both the telephone solicitation prohibitions as well as the fax prohibitions. And finally, Appellee's stress of this section, I think, also makes this point. The section in which of the TCPA in which the fax prohibition is found also, or in which the prohibitions on telephone solicitations are found, also contain the fax prohibitions. If the FCC had wanted to limit its definition to the telephone solicitation portions of the of the TCPA, it would have used the word subsection. None of the later FCC pronouncements on which either the district court or defendant has ever relied do anything other than refer back to the definition in the 1992 order. I think that in every case, there's a footnote citing to the 1995 order for the definition, and the 1995 order itself cites back to the 1992 order. Further, if the FCC had wanted to draw a distinction between the way established business relationship is understood when you're talking about a fax versus how it's understood when you're talking about a telephone call, it could have done so within the footnote in which it purports to create this defense. It didn't do so, and instead chose to use a universally defined term. I think the other point I'd like to respond to is the notion that we're making an argument that this isn't a rule. 1992 in report and order is most clearly a rule, but what we're concerned about in this case, and the only thing within that report and order that defendants have ever been concerned with, is footnote 87. Footnote 87 is part of the commentary to that order. It's nothing that appears in the ultimate enacting clauses of the CFR, and furthermore, starts off by saying, we recognize that we are not empowered to create any defenses under the TCPA. We note, however, that established business relationship can be a form of express permission or invitation. And what that means is that the FCC itself is saying we're not creating anything that's going to bind a court. We are interpreting what Congress said. And the crux of our argument is what Congress said is clear from what it put in the statute, and there's no need to refer to anyone else's interpretation of it. I thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Jeff. And thanks to both counsel. The case is taken under advisement.